Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
The documentary Simple as Water looks at the effects of the Syrian war through the eyes of four families spread across five countries. One is a young man in Pennsylvania. His name is Omar, and he's a delivery driver. And he's taking care of his younger brother, who's 16, and who lost a leg in a rocket blast back in Syria. At one point, Omar is at a meeting with his brother Abdi's teacher.
He knows that you, I don't know if it's pressure, but he knows that he needs to be successful. Like, he knows that that's important to you and that he wants to make you proud.
I am grateful for everything. Grateful for the fact that he's trying, that he's not stuck with the past.
Simple as Water is filmed in both English and Arabic, and it's on the shortlist for an Oscar nomination. You can watch it on HBO and HBO Max, and the filmmaker Megan Mylan joins us. Congratulations, Megan, and welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So what brought you to this story?
I think, like most of your listeners, back in 2015, I just became consumed with watching the mass exodus out of Syria, and particularly the families crossing between Turkey and Greece. And I was waking up every morning with that news, really just unable to reconcile how we lived in a world that would allow people who had managed to get themselves out of a war zone to then have to negotiate with smugglers and climb barbed wire. And one of the things that was going on in my life at the time is I was the mother of a three-year-old and sort of seeing the world through the perspective of my son. And so with the migrant crisis, it was my trying to figure out whether if I was in that same situation, would I rise to the occasion? How would I say that just very simple phrase we should all be able to say of everything's going to be okay? You know, that kind of almost a throwaway line of parents say, and just really unable to get wrap my head and heart around it. And at some point, if you make documentaries for a living, as I do, you start trying to figure out if what you have to contribute is a film. And I struggled for a bit to figure out what my point of entry would be. And then I really came back to what my point of entry as a human being had been, at that point of view of sort of what war does to families and all of the excruciating choices that parents have to make.
Well, we hear so many of these parents say, inshallah, right? God willing, which, you know, perhaps could be a throwaway phrase, but we know in this context that these families separated are really saying, God willing, I'm going to reconnect with the loved ones in my life. So the first one up is Yasmin. She lives in Greece with four of her children. And we're going to hear a little sound of her children blowing up balloons and running and laughing. Let's take a listen. They live in a refugee tent city right next to a busy port in Greece. And Yasmin's husband is far away, a refugee in Germany. And what struck me is one of her children mentions letting a brother slip through our hands. Tell us about that.
They had, like many, tried to get across. The father had gone ahead. And they attempted, Yasmin and her kids tried to cross seven different times. And in one of those, their boat capsized, and the youngest of her children was in the water for a very long time. And when they got to land, it didn't survive more than a couple of days. And it's each family in the film has some unspeakable loss, yet they also have this intense determination. I mean, one of the things I love in the clip that you just played, it's different to experience it with just the audio, but is you hear all of the laughter too. And Yasmin was so focused on her children's joy, despite the fact that they were living in a tent city with all sorts of insecurities and unknowns. When they would see their father again, where they would be living, when they'd be back in school, she still kept many of the routines of daily life. That's the determination that you see, and that's so common to our human experiences, that we want our families obviously physically safe, but we want people thriving too. And so displaced families, that's true for as it is for anyone else.
Well, speaking of thriving, one of your other characters in Turkey is another mother, Samira. And she lives with five of her children, her husband was, as she says, taken by the regime. And every day as she works in the fields, her 12-year-old son, the oldest, watches over his four siblings. I mean, speaking of thriving, he helps them to wash, helps them to take naps. He helps them get through the day. And then we learn the horrible choice in front of her. What's the choice?
Yeah, so Samra is, you know, working in the fields. Her children are at home unattended, except for Fayez, their 12-year-old big brother, who's taken on, you know, the role of really the father in the family. And Samra knows that he's being robbed of his childhood. And so she takes Fayez and one of her other boys to visit Beiti, which is an orphanage and boarding school for children who have lost their parents or whose parents are unable to take care of them. And so she's just faced with making this excruciating choice of, is the best way to provide a childhood and education and a safe home for her children to separate from them? And Fayez, the oldest, is resolute that that will not happen, and that he can serve as a father to his siblings, and that, you know, that they've lost too much and that what they need to do is stay together. And so, you know, it's just excruciating, but it's what war does.
Yeah. Children who have to grow up so quickly is a theme that you go into here. There's an older brother. This is Omar, who lives in Pennsylvania. We talked about it at the top of the story. His brother is an amputee. And as you tell the story, he meets with his lawyer, who says his application for asylum in America has been denied. So it brings up, you know, the possibility of awful choices and separation again. And what I close my eyes and see is the scene of Omar's face as he processes it, turns away, it looks like he's teary. There are many of these moments in this film. Was it important for you to train the camera on people's faces to capture that? It's almost when they go from the public face to the private face.
I think one of the keys to people revealing things on their faces and to us and our crew is our having established trust and a sense of collaboration with them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they don't forget that you're there, but you become, you know, you're an invited guest. And so, you know, we were always very respectful of this sacred space of family that we've been invited into. And you go through it with them, you know, and we didn't know what was going to happen that day, and nor did he. You know, and so just being like a quiet, trusted presence, I think is sort of the key.
There is one person you profile who struggles to move forward, and that is the elderly woman in Syria, Dia. We see her on her phone calling and messaging frantically, looking for her son, who has been captured. I think she believes he's been captured by ISIS, and it's been 5 years, and it's searing to watch her face and her. This is this slow desperation.
طيب ماشي بس يروحوا للضيوف احكي معي بس انه طمني اكتب لي كلمتين فعلا في تبادل اسرى بين قسد وداعش بالحسكه.
But as far as capturing this film in Syria, how were you able to do that?
So, you know, half of Syria was forced to flee, but half stayed behind. And one of the really excruciating aspects and heinous aspects of the Assad regime is this forced disappearance, where people are just taken arbitrarily and you never know. And ISIS was a piece of that, too, though most of it was through the regime. And I felt like that not knowing whether your child was alive or not, not knowing what was happening to them, was one of the aspects of what war does to parents that was important to include. But it was very, very difficult for a foreign crew to go in. It felt like, you know, it would be unsafe for me, unsafe for the crew, but most importantly, unsafe for a family that we would focus on. And so what we did is we worked through two Syrian women who are credited in the film under pseudonyms, and we identified a family who had already been public about their son being missing so that, you know, we felt okay with their choosing to take this risk. I went to Beirut and workshopped with them. We managed to get footage out to Beirut, but really, you know, there in the home, it's their relationship and their trust that they built with her that allowed us to be able to share her story, which felt like a very important one to include in this film.
Yeah. Well, such and again, searing portraits of individuals and loss. We don't want to give it all away, but there is some good news in reconnecting at the end of your documentary. But finally, I want to ask you, Megan, as a filmmaker, is there one anecdote, one moment in this film that's going to stay with you?
There are so many moments from this film.
Yeah.
But our final chapter focuses on fathers in Germany. And there's a scene where three Syrian men are, one of them is a barber, and he's giving haircuts. And they're all fathers. And they're all talking about their complicated feelings of having gone ahead to Germany, having found safety and not been able to bring their families with them, and the layers of guilt that they feel for not being able to be hands-on fathers. And I was the only woman in the room as we were filming that, and it was a take on fatherhood and expressions of fatherly love that I hadn't heard before, and that felt very, very privileged. And so I was grateful to have been there, and I'll take that with me.
Yeah. Megan Mylan's documentary is Simple as Water. Megan, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.